two men have been charged in connection with Friday's attack on a concert venue just outside Moscow. Authorities now say at least 137 people died after four gunmen fired at concert goers before setting the building on fire.
Well, today was in the wake of a devastating Islamist terror attack in Moscow, the dark arts of spreading disinformation are once again in evidence. Russia's President Vladimir Putin wasted no time in pinning blame on Ukraine, a sobering example of the old proverb that a lie is halfway around the world before the truth can get its boots on. So how can democracies confront information warfare from their adversaries? And how might countering that disinformation need to change in an era of burgeoning artificial intelligence, with a wider array of countries and malign actors purveying fake news and analysis with real-life consequences? Welcome to Power Play from Politico, where we talk to some of the world's most influential players on either side of the Atlantic. I'm Anne McElvoy, and my guest this week knows a thing or two about the smoke and mirrors of international diplomacy. James Rubin leads the Global Engagement Center within the US State Department. Reporting directly to Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, his job is to disentangle the propaganda and disinformation efforts targeting America and its allies all around the world. A former senior aide in the Clinton administration, James has lived in London and New York, and he's been close to centres of power on both sides of the Atlantic over several decades. Here's the conversation I had with him at the Munich Security Conference a few weeks ago. James Rubin, welcome to Power Play.
Nice to be with you, Anne.
I have a basic question for you about disinformation, which is, do we know what it is and how it differs from simply influence peddling or propaganda, or maybe just an account of the world that we don't agree with?
Exactly. You've put your finger on what's the difficult part of the job that I've taken on, is that disinformation is becoming a word almost like fake news, where people just use it to describe a story they don't like. Politicians even do that in countries I visited in Eastern Europe. You'll work with them on disinformation, and they'll say, I saw this story yesterday, was disinformation. And then you look at it, and as you point out, it was just an article they didn't like. That's not the disinformation that I fight. What I'm trying to do, and the U.S. government is trying to do, is make sure that throughout the information domain, which is so complicated these days, that when the Kremlin or the PRC has generated some news, some information, some idea, that their stamp is on it, that their hand is not hidden, so that we know that it's a Russian-generated story. Because let's take a simple example. If you're in Bulgaria, say, and you see news that says U.S. has biological weapons in Ukraine, you might or might not believe it. But if you saw Russia says U.S. has biological weapons in Ukraine, then you'd be less likely to believe it. So it seems to me that step one in this fight is to ensure the provenance of news, the transparency of news, the labeling of news is done properly, so that when the Kremlin or the Chinese conduct an information operation, which they do every day and all over the world, that their name is on it. And then people can make their own judgment as to whether it's true or not. We're not trying to decide what's true or not. In the United States, freedom of information is a fundamental value. There's no way the government will try to decide that. What we can do and what we must do is make sure that when the Russians and the Chinese are conducting these operations, that everyone knows it.
You're in the Global Engagement Center in the State Department. Global is the name on the tin there. It sounds like trying to find a lot of needles in many haystacks all around the world. Could you just give us an overview of trend? Is disinformation rising, which may be what people assume, or are Western democracies getting better at combating it?
Well, I think you've hit a question that has the answer to both. It is rising, but we are getting better at it. I think at the most basic level, we need to remember that China and Russia, the PRC, the Kremlin, spend billions and billions of dollars on information warfare every day all over the world. While the United States and our Western allies here in Europe are really just getting started, because for too long people thought that social media, the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram were tools to spread the truth, and they didn't realize that these social media tools have a dark side, a very dark side, in which the Russian government and the Chinese government, the Communist Party of China, can use social media against the West. And we got to remember, at the most fundamental level, there is an asymmetry. Russia and China have closed off their information space. The West, the world, cannot enter the Chinese wall that they've created. And increasingly, Russia has created a wall of its own, with only just a few places in which true news, true information is able to go through. That means that we are at a disadvantage. They can play all over the world, and it's our world that gets flooded with this information warfare, while in their part of the world, they've shut it down.
I was about to ask you who the worst offenders are, but implicitly you've said so because you've mentioned Russia and China a lot. I'm curious about whether they act independently, autonomously, or whether there is a sense of connection now in the way that we're seeing that tacit cooperation around the war in Ukraine, or at least China making it easier for Russia to pursue its goals there.
Well, thank you actually for that question, because the degree to which China repeats Russian lies about this war in Ukraine is truly monstrous. Ever since the war began, the Russians have invented some crazy stories about the United States, about Ukraine, about military-industrial complex, about colonialism, whatever they can try, including this famous lie about biological weapon labs in Ukraine. And what is troubling, and troubling in the extreme, is that Chinese government officials have repeated those lies about the war in Ukraine. Ever since this war started some 2 years ago, official and unofficial Chinese information operations have repeated the Russian argument for the war. So in the context of the information space, Russia and China are fully aligned. That may not be true in terms of providing weapons, and we've been successful in preventing China from, or deterring really, China from providing actual weapons to the Russians. But in the information space, which is a weapon of its own, the Chinese are in full alignment with Russia.
I have a bit of a challenge here. Of course, there's no equivalence between Ukraine and Russia. But some people listening might say, well, hang on a minute, if a negative account of the war in Ukraine emerges, things are going badly, something gets out that basically does not suit Volodymyr Zelensky to have public, where does that then fit into this narrative when you say China is supporting Russia in a harmful narrative about the war in Ukraine? There's obviously an outright lie. Biological weapons take to be an outright lie, though people will also want to be quite testing around that. Are you clear to yourself what is a negative account that doesn't suit, and what is disinformation in this context of a war?
Good question, Anne. It's not an easy one to answer. Let me try to deconstruct it a bit. Let's distinguish between the causes of the war, the reasons for the war, and the war itself. So one morning, Vladimir Putin woke up and invaded his neighbor with hundreds of thousands of troops. That is a fact. That was his decision. And he did it for his own crazy reasons. That initiative has failed. They've been unable to force Ukraine to succumb to Russian power. The war itself, the military operations that are going on every day in eastern Ukraine, in the Black Sea, etc., that's a place where war reporters are doing their job. And some days, war reporters report things that aren't necessarily in the interest of Vladimir Zelensky, but in a democracy that we hope and increasingly see Ukraine becoming, that they can understand that having war reporters cover the war, even if occasionally there's bad news, is a far better life than the controlled environment that Russia has placed on all of its people, such that it is increasingly resembling the Soviet Union in terms of the crackdown on information and dissent inside Russia. So, in short, the Ukrainian democracy is an emerging democracy. It's not a full-fledged democratic state yet. We think it's moving in the right direction on all the different indicators, but sometimes the Ukrainian government may, you know, resist the kind of freedom of information that's normal for us.
Let's widen out the lens here and talk about the conflict in Israel-Gaza. And I'm curious, we haven't touched on Iran just when you run us through the major offenders. So there is Iran, which sits in that group and from the Western democratic prism, or even the democracy world, never mind Western, of being a bad actor and basically wishing harm to the democratic system and what used to be called the rules-based order. Do you think Iran fits in the same frame as what you're talking about?
I do. I think that in the information space, the information domain, which is where I work and where I am struggling to get a better source of labeling into the system so that we know whether it's a Russian story or in a Chinese-generated story or an Iranian-generated story. You know, the Iranians are playing in this space. They're trying to convince people that October 7th never happened, that the Israelis have invented the events of October 7th. Others have suggested that. Secretary Blinken, when he was at the Davos conference earlier this year, who really does understand the conflict in the Middle East from both its physical and its information aspects, pointed out that the trouble isn't just that we are working with a multi-front war in the north and the south and in Gaza, but also that the information warriors from the other side, that is the Russians and the Iranians and sometimes even the Chinese, have convinced a lot of people that October 7th never happened.
And you're sure that that's Iran? I mean, let's just ask a bit of a sort of handicraft question. How can you tell?
Well, what I can say to you is that we have observed over and over again Russian, Chinese, and Iranian alignment on trying to deny the causes of the war in Gaza. Many of them, all of them, have blamed the United States for this war. The larger truth that's going on that we're now touching on by moving from Ukraine to Gaza is that we have a new reality in the world. The Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians place a very, very high premium on the information domain. They spend an enormous amount of money in manpower and actual cash. And what they have done in crisis after crisis is do what I can only describe as a kind of a knee-jerk blame America first. So when the COVID happened, this was clearly a Chinese virus. Whether it was from a lab or an animal is still to be determined, but it clearly started in China. And yet both Russia and China tried to claim it started in the United States. Same thing on Ukraine.
We'll hear more from James Rubin on how AI might pose a new threat and part of a solution to fake news after this. For a lot of listeners, disinformation is primarily associated with that targeting of the 2016 election in the US, the election meddling driven by Russia and the ensuing kind of unraveling of that and how that came about. Do you think we understand entirely what happened?
Well, I need to right here make very clear that in my job at the GEC, I focus exclusively on the rest of the world. I don't look at the United States because I work at the State Department. There are other agencies, the FBI, Homeland Security, the Justice Department, that look at the domestic space. And I think the Justice Department has spoken pretty clearly on this as to what happened with the Internet Research Agency and Prigozhin and all of the disinformation efforts conducted back then. But I'm only saying that as a reference to what the Justice Department reported publicly. It's not part of my daily work. My daily work is as a sort of a mini general in the information war everywhere else but the United States.
I like, just pause for a minute on you as a mini general in the information war. Is this the way that you get into your combat fatigues in the digital sphere?
Well, in a way, I wake up every morning. It's true. And, you know, jobs are always tricky and how you're motivated and how much work you have to do, and you try to figure out what it is that you're actually doing and so that you're providing value added. And yeah, I think of myself as an operational general trying to defend the world actively and passively by building resilience in countries from Russian and Chinese information operations, and by revealing Russian operations. You haven't asked me about this, but one of the things that we have done very recently that was something we're very pleased about is we were able to reveal in Africa a Russian intelligence operation to spread the news all through Africa that Western medical care was dangerous. Think about how monstrous that is if African citizens are hearing that Western medical care is dangerous. They may not go to the doctor. They may not go to the Gates Foundation. They may not get vaccinations, and they may die because they listen to Russian disinformation. So we were able to reveal this before it got started, because the trick to disinformation is you got to get it early before it spreads. There are always going to be people who believe conspiracy theories. That's just the world we live in. There have been movies about biological labs in Africa and, you know, and big pharma doing things that were dastardly in the films. So people see that, and Russia tries to play on it. But if you can make sure that that effort is revealed early, before it gets started, before the information warriors of the Russians spread their dastardly news all over the continent, then you can get a label on it, and then people are far less likely to believe it, and then they'll get the health care they need. But the fact that Russia would play with the lives of Africans in this way and damage their willingness to get needed health care.
What countries were affected there, just to be specific on that?
In West Africa, they invented the idea that the work of the Western medical care was responsible for dengue fever. Throughout the region where the Gates Foundation is doing miracle work on malaria, where the West, through its PEPFAR program, has saved millions of lives through the AIDS medications. Those are the programs the Russians are targeting all over Africa, but in particular in West Africa with the dengue fever.
Another region we should touch on is the Western Balkans. It takes us back to when we first met in that part of the world. That was a period of disruption after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and I think rather to the surprise of many politicians and analysts, that just spilled over in a bad way. Many good things happened in 89-90, of course, unification of Germany, etc. But it then did create or re-fire up this tinderbox of the Balkans, and that is an area I think that you have done quite a lot of work on, the impact of Russian disinformation. What's sort of changed from the time that we left those conflicts sometimes frozen, sometimes stewing a bit, to where we are now with Vladimir Putin, master of all these surveys in the Kremlin, and to an extent also very influential in the region?
Well, you're right that the Kremlin focuses a lot of attention on information operations in the Balkans. And unfortunately, they have a ready and willing outlet in RT and Sputnik and Serbian language RT that's broadcast from Serbia. And that is a terrible shame, because these kind of crazy stories that we've talked about here today are being promulgated over and over again through Serbian-based RT and Serbian language RT. And that has resulted in a lot more tensions and a lot more confusions and a lot more damage in the Balkans than there should be. I returned to Kosovo in this job about a year ago or 9 months ago. And I was, you know, blown away by how far they'd come from the days when they were Kosovo Albanian population were about to be slaughtered, and many were slaughtered by the Serbs, to a thriving democratic country that is really, you know, I went to restaurants and went out and I felt like I was in Brooklyn, not Pristina. It was amazing. But there are some of these conflicts, as you put it, that haven't caused a denial of that progress in Bosnia, for example, where it seems frozen by the ethnic-based government in Bosnia, the Serb-based government. And in Serbia, while some days they seem to want to join the European Union, on other days they seem to be perfectly happy to be the host of the Russian disinformation operations.
We've focused here on distribution channels for disinformation, rightly, like RT out of the Kremlin or Sputnik. But what about the role of social media platforms based in the free and democratic world, and a lot of them headquartered in the US, in fact, mainly headquartered in the US. They've come in for criticism recently in that heated session that we heard in Congress about negative impacts, harmful impacts of some information that is going around, whether it's on Meta or indeed on Elon Musk-owned X. How much do you engage directly with the platforms, and do you think you're getting anywhere in that argument?
The social media question is a tricky one for a person in my position, because my colleagues in Europe have regulatory power and they can engage directly with potential fines and potential penalties to social media companies that don't comply with really their own terms of service. If all the social media companies enforced their own terms of service, much of the problem would be solved. We do work with them in the following sense. We meet with them. We try to discuss the trends and the tactics that are used by manipulative countries or non-state actors. We work on that with them. We consult with them. They tell us what they're seeing. We tell them what we're seeing. But in our country, we have freedom of information, and the social media companies are not subject to regulation. So our ability to influence them is very limited. And frankly, in my job, this has been a subject where people have gotten very confused. We do not ask them to take things down. That's not what the GEC does. We look at the rest of the world, and it's the other governments that are in contact with social media companies about what is on the, say, in the Meta platform in Bosnia or in Bulgaria or in some other place. So that's up to other governments. What we do with them is talk about the problem, because I certainly hope that one day the leaders of those organizations would really look themselves in the mirror and realize that this great tool that was created in America has been turned against the American way by the Russians and the Chinese, and that they would spend as much time trying to fix that problem as they are in their profit-making.
We can't leave this without talking about AI, of course, the very rapid developments there, and generative AI and its ability to impact the information battleground, where you are a general in your shirt sleeves. How much are you thinking about using AI, and what are the pros and cons of doing so to combat information which may be being driven out of AI?
Right. AI is the next generation technology that can affect people's lives in what they think, what they know, what they hear, can affect the basic facts that are required for democracies to function properly. I believe we are facing information warfare, both from existing technology and from supercharged by the possibility of AI-generated disinformation. And the only way I think we can deal with that is for the countries that believe in freedom of information but also want to prevent Russia and China from spoiling the information environment have to band together in a coalition. So we've created a framework, a diplomatic framework to do that, which committed the British, the Canadians, the United States to work together to try to combat the existing challenge and figure out a way in the AI environment to make sure that there is tagging, there is watermarking, that people will know when it's generated by AI or it's not generated by AI.
Can you use AI yourself, or are there still big questions about that, not just technologically, but in a sense almost ideologically, about the idea of using AI to combat AI by hostile actors?
My colleague, Liz Allen, who's the Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy, is working with all of the ambassadors and all the public affairs officers all over the world. And yes, we can use artificial intelligence if we use it properly under the right rules. The good news about AI as compared to social media is that right away the companies that are creating this technology are doing something today they didn't do 15, 20 years ago, which is realize the risks. And they are working with the government instead of seeing government as the adversary to try to ensure that as this technology evolves, that the risks are dealt with properly. So the U.S. government is going to work on some rules for how AI can be used legitimately, how AI information can be watermarked, and then we're going to try to ensure that other governments around the world do that here, and that's part of my job. But first, we all need to realize we in the world that believes in democracies and doesn't believe in the might makes right of Russia and the PRC have to unite in a coalition to say that we want to protect our information space. And that's what my main job is. That's why I'm going to London. We've had Tony Blinken in Albania signed a diplomatic framework with them. We need to get Asian countries, European countries first, but then as much of the world as possible to agree with the premise that disinformation is a national security imperative and we have to deal with it.
We can't let you go without asking you something. It's a test we give to everyone who comes on Power Plays. Who would you like to hear, James Rubin, to become a regular listener?
That's a very good question. I guess we have a terrific Secretary of State. He hasn't yet been on your show. I can certainly tell him that it's a very fair-minded, tough but fair show, and certainly Tony Blinken would be a guy as Secretary of State who would make me want to listen.
That's great. If you could just sort that out, Jay, we will get back to you. Now, of course, we would love to have the Secretary of State on Power Play. Maybe we could fix that up. And thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Anne, on this beautiful day.
And that's all for this week's edition. We wish you all a very happy Easter and hope you enjoyed our transatlantic conversation. Do keep listening. Perhaps give us a rate and review when you're in an especially sunny mood. If you'd like to get all of our episodes immediately they publish, follow Power Play wherever you're listening. The team behind this podcast is Peter Snowden, senior producer in London, and the executive producer in Berlin, Christina Gonzalez. I'm Anne McElvoy, and thank you for listening.